This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Funimation and their latest feature, Evangelion 1.01. You're not alone. The movie is the complete rebuild of the groundbreaking sci-fi giant robot anime. Imagine having Dr. Frankenstein as your father. Your classmate and fellow pilot is a partial clone of your dead mother, and she's hot. You've been forced by your father to pilot a giant living robot named Ava Unit 01 to fight deadly creatures called angels from destroying the planet. And to top it off, you have raging teenage hormones, and it's the end of the world if you screw up. No pressure. Otaku USA Magazine writes that Evangelion reminds us of what anime can be by having us flex all our okaru muscles, yet always satisfies our basis needs for cute girls and mecha. You can watch the first 8 minutes of the movie online at Funimation.com/EVANGELION. That's Funimation.com/Evangelion. Evangelion 1.01, you're not alone. It's available now on DVD. In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. You know all those cool changes I told you about coming up at Word Balloon? Well, they've begun. If you go to wordballoon.com, the website has gotten a much-needed facelift. It's the start of further changes and features that you'll be seeing at wordballoon.com, and I wanted to tell you about that right up front before we even get to the subject of today's guest, Mr. Matt Wagner. Whether it's his creator-owned characters like Grendel and Mage or his runs on characters like the Golden Age Sandman and Batman, Matt continues to be one of those creators that puts exciting, fresh ideas on every concept he touches. Today's show focuses on his current work, both for Vertigo and Dynamite. For Vertigo, he's been doing great work on Madame Xanadu, with artists like Amy Reed Hadley and Mike Kaluta. We'll be talking about the current story arc and what's in the future for Madame Xanadu. Matt's busy at Dynamite as well, not only on Zorro, where the work continues on a new story arc called Tales of the Fox. We're also talking about Matt's 2010 debut of the Golden Age Green Hornet, drawn by Aaron Campbell. Matt goes into detail on what he thinks makes the Hornet and Kato tick, and how their Golden Age environment informs the characters that they are. That very idea, in a broader sense, is where our conversation begins.
You told me you just came back from Vegas, and you were at a conference for the Library Association down there?
Yeah, for the Public Library Association, they do a Las Vegas Book Festival, and the last couple of years they've had one day that concentrates specifically on comic books.
Cool. And
that was kind of neat.
Yeah, and well, yeah, tell me about, you said you had a panel of, you know, kind of spotlight on you, but then you were also on a Batman panel?
I was on a Batman panel, and it was me and Mark Evanier and Steve Englehart and Michael Uslan.
Okay.
And you know, everybody's pretty much on the same page. It's all kind of like, yeah, we love Batman, you know.
I mean, yay, Batman, sure.
What can you say, you know? And so then I decided to kind of stir up the pot a little bit and introduce the theory that it became a little more provocative than I thought it would be. I said, look, I'd like to make the point and ask the panel what they think about this, in that I think pretty much any pop culture character is endemic to the time and place they were created. And by that I mean Sherlock Holmes can't exist out of Victorian London. The shadow doesn't really work in a time where every man on the street wasn't wearing a hat. And similarly, I think even though Batman and Superman have had very amazing longevities, I think that their characters are based around the society and the technology of the late 20th century. And that I think we might be seeing that come to an end before too long, that you won't be able to update those characters anymore. Even though they've had many successful retcons over the year. But, you know, in an age when every single character, every single person in the world carries a portable camera in the form of their phone and can immediately access pretty much the internet and spread information around the globe in a matter of seconds, it's really hard for it to be believable that any character could maintain a secret identity.
Interesting.
And that's why I think the Marvel characters kind of replaced them. Specifically, the X-Men has really come to the forefront because they, if you think about it, they are characters who exist without a sense of privacy, whose powers and abnormal characteristics have thrust them into a limelight against their will. And they can't have secret identities. They try and hide out, and it doesn't work for them. The rest of the panel just wasn't catching what I was trying to say there. They viewed it more as kind of like an attack on Batman, you know. And I was just kind of like, look, Batman's great. I understand that. I agree with that, you know. And somebody made the point, well, these sort of stories are, you know, they're eternal. They go back to the days of Beowulf and Odysseus. And I said, look, I can talk that Campbellian archetype all day long, you know.
Yes, you can.
But Odysseus, you know, wore sandals and had a bronze shield and a sword. You don't see guys using that in modern-day New York. Similarly, you know, you're not – the structures that made Batman and Superman stories unique aren't going to resonate – with either viewers or readers at a certain point. By way of illustration, I said, look at it this way. What does Clark Kent work for?
That's where I was going to ask you in terms of where to go next in this
he
talk.
Works, he works for a newspaper.
Yes.
Those are
dinosaurs.
Becoming obsolete.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. But much like they did in the 70s, putting him in television, which presented its own problems.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Both in the story and I think writing stories. But, no, I agree with you, and I understand where you're coming from on
and
that.
And it wasn't, you know, again, I was not trying to attack those characters at all. I think those characters are wonderful, and there will come a point where it's like we can't keep updating these because, again, they're based on the world of the late 20th century, the latter half of the 20th century, and it won't be too long till the latter half of the 20th century is a memory. It isn't as immediate as it is right now.
That's so funny, Matt, because I've even been thinking about starting a different podcast called either Last Gasps of the 20th Century or Crawling to Extinction. Those are the two titles that I'm...
Yep.
And you're right. I mean, specifically staying in the realm of heroes, does the Lone Ranger work in modern era? Does Zorro work in modern era? No, they're
cowboys.
In fact,
I mentioned that on the panel. There was a... Zorro Productions has actually done a modern version of Zorro, you know, and he's riding around on a black motorcycle, you know, and he's still wearing a cape for some reason. And, you know, and Michael Uslan made the point of, you know, well, I don't agree with that because look at Batman Beyond. They updated Batman. I said, yeah, but that's not Batman. It's a different guy.
But it's a different guy. Well, yeah, that's true.
A different guy, and his world is completely removed from his world, his technology is removed from the 20th century. It's Batman in name only, you know.
What about, and now I'm going to throw out an incredibly old thing that only you and I would know, but what about the 1940s Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes World War II films, for example?
Well, I never particularly liked those.
Okay.
I thought they were too modern.
Interesting. Okay. I made the kind of
again, provocative point that, you know.
No,
If you had two middle-aged men living together these days like that, everybody would think they were queers, you know? And it never raised an eyebrow in Victorian London because it was very common for people to share living space, you know?
We're simply sharing lodgings, sir.
Exactly, you know? But again, I think all these characters are endemic, and I think, you know, there's going to be a new archetype that will arise, you know. Batman can't have a goddamn Facebook page. You know, it just is not
or
part of the
character. Or tweet a lot.
Yeah, or tweet a lot, exactly. It's just ridiculous. It's just not, that's why, I don't know if you ever read how many years ago was it out now, about 4 or 5 years ago, the novelist Tom DeHaven, do you know who that is?
Oh, yeah.
He did a book that was commissioned by DC a number of years ago called It's Superman.
Yes, indeed.
And it's Superman set in the 30s.
And it's great.
It's fabulous, yeah. But again, you're just, when you read that, you're just reminded, God, this character was born of this era. And it makes sense to keep him in that era, you know.
Kevin Anderson actually just released a book that was kind of in the same era, and it's like Batman and Superman meeting in 1939.
Right, but it's based around Cold War paranoia, isn't it?
Oh, maybe it is set in the 50s. I don't know.
I think it's set in the 50s, yeah.
Okay.
Isn't it called, what's it called?
You know, I can't remember either.
Something Enemies, right? Isn't it?
I think it is like, not Public Enemies. That of course, is the new DVD movie that they just made.
Right,
based on Loeb's story. But, no, you know, honestly, Matt, I welcome these kind of conversations, and there is no right answer. And it is interesting to kind of explore when the rubber band breaks. Because I think you're right. Again, pointing to Zorro
and you know, Mark Manier kept saying, you know, well, it's a fairy tale. It's unbelievable anyway. And I was like, yeah, but you're missing my point. It's that, you know, fairy tales, you know, Grimm's fairy tales, I would say Grimm's fairy tales have lost a lot of their punch for young kids because they were written, you know, in what, medieval Europe or Renaissance Europe. And even though there are certain resonance there, the only way they appeal to modern kids is when Disney takes them and fills them all full of modern pulp culture references.
Right, gives them Robin Williams' voice, and there's a few catchphrases.
Exactly. And... so, you know, this, the fact that it's believable or unbelievable, that's not the point of what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking about when it has, how long a character has staying power and what time period that applies to, you know.
Oh, no, I agree.
If you look at the Marvel characters in general, and again, I'm not even trying to turn this into a Marvel DC thing versus DC thing. It's just time marching on, you know. But the Marvel characters, aside from, like, Spider-Man, and I mean the classic Marvel characters here, Spider-Man and I guess you could say Captain America, they don't have secret identities. The Fantastic Four, everybody knows who they are. Everybody knows Bruce Banner's the Hulk. You know, I guess Daredevil has a secret identity. But for the most part, they're forced to live in public, you know, as what they are.
That's true, and also I think right now it's too soon to their origin years as well, and I think the atomic and computer age are still close enough to our current age.
I agree with that. Yeah,
you know, it's they can make a shift,
and
it's an easier shift than those classic, you know, 30s and 40s characters.
But you know, I mean, it's always been a bit of a stretch that you know, Superman with a pair of eyeglasses and a slouch and a difference in attitude can hide himself. Well, back in the 30s, that wasn't that outrageous. Look at John Dillinger and characters like that you know, were wanted criminals and yet seemed to find places to exist. They weren't in total hiding all the time. Photography wasn't as prevalent. You weren't able to broadcast everybody's likeness all over the world immediately. Similarly, a character like Bruce Wayne, you know, a very rich millionaire, well, millionaires used to have secret lives, and they don't anymore.
Yeah.
They're every little, they sneeze, and it's you know, a matter of scandal, you know. And anyway.
No, you're right, and they're every one of these heroes is one TMZ or Google Earth moment away.
Exactly.
From
absolute
secret
exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
in fact,
they
even touch on that a little bit in the latest Batman movie, in The Dark Knight, where it's the Wayne Industries accountant figures out that he's Batman.
Yes.
You know. Well, how long is it going to be before somebody else figures it out too? You know.
No, I understand, and that's interesting to hear because I was wondering if, based on what you're currently doing, both at DC and Dynamite, at Vertigo. I should say Vertigo, I suppose. I was wondering with what they're doing with this first wave, all the Street and Smith pulp heroes and their own pulp heroes and the Spirit, if you were possibly going to ever be part of that mix.
No, I haven't been asked to be yet, so... and I'm busy enough with the other projects I got on deck.
Okay.
It's not my immediate future, but...
But
in keeping with that same thing we were just talking about there, if you look at it, yeah, Madame Xanadu, a character that spans... centuries and centuries, and we're still not up to what you'd call a current time period in the narrative. And of course, Zorro's set in his very peculiar time and place. And you know, we just announced that I'm going to be writing Green Hornet Year One. Well,
yes.
that's set in the 30s as well.
Oh, we're talking about all that today. Go ahead.
Yeah. So you know, all these things are, you know, I like to keep it in the appropriate time period. You know.
Well, I know, You are exactly the kind of guy, Matt, that I think a lot of us adult fans were hoping for in terms of somebody that grew up on all of this stuff but now can approach it writing to a much more adult audience.
And
it's a pleasure to hear these conversations of all of these characters, whether they're the Arthurian characters or the Golden Age DC characters. And really, it was what made Sandman Mystery Theater such a fun read as well, and I see obvious, you know, stripes of that in Madame Xanadu, and it's really a pleasure to read.
Well, you know, and Xanadu is fun because when you have a character that long lived, you're not tied to any time period. You can just choose one and go with it, you know. And of course, you know, as I've mentioned in other interviews, my parents are of the World War II generation. My dad was born in 21, my mom was born in 25. And so, you know, they were teenagers during the golden age of comics and radio, and so I have a genuine inherited nostalgia for those times from them. As a result, I'm very happy to be working on this Green Hornet gig. It's a lot of fun. And of course, Zorro's a totally different ball of wax where you got to, like, for instance, you got to keep telling yourself, no dynamite yet. You know what I mean? And I don't mean Dynamite the publisher. I mean, in Zorro's world, dynamite hasn't been invented yet.
I understand.
You know?
Very cool.
The guns are all single-shot muskets, that sort of thing, you know, and you have to keep it endemic to its time and place.
Well, but that makes it easier for him to dodge bullets, so that's good.
Yeah, that's for sure, yeah. And in fact, I don't know if you remember from the first story arc, we put in a little thing in there where that's why he wears the cloak, because it helps disguise his form.
Certainly.
You know, a cloak wouldn't work at all against a semi-automatic rifle, but, you know, a guy firing a long, heavy musket, you know, might think that your body's 6 inches a little more to the left than it actually is, and it serves to confuse his aim.
Are we still too early for the Gatling gun? Or whatever the repeat, you know, the...
I'm pretty sure, yeah, no, the Gatling gun's not invented until, I don't know, I'm going to look that up as we're talking here.
All right, and I was going to say, maybe I mischaracterized.
Yeah, Gatling gun 1861, according to my computer here.
Okay, because, so I'm thinking of that hand crank machine gun, if that's not a Gatling gun.
That's a Gatling gun, yeah.
Okay, there you go.
And that's a good 50 years after what I'm working on now.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's the thing, and it's, as you say, and I've seen you say this in other interviews as well, the problems, too, that he solves can't, you know, this can't move too fast either.
Right.
And that,
right, because it's, a can in a movie. That's what a movie does. In 2 hours, he has to beat the bad guys. You know?
California is free. The end.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But here, you know, it has to be, and that, you know, to my mind, that helps make the scenario all the more believable, that one guy couldn't upend the entire status quo of the government and everything in several adventures, you know.
Definitely. Well, no, and I'm glad you really were a fan of the book that came out, the novel, and I always forget her name.
Isabel Allende. Mm-hmm.
Awesome book.
Yeah, it was great.
And it was great,
and I was able to cherry-pick a whole lot of the story points out of there.
Yep.
Now, my task was to take that and turn it into a comic book story, because in the novel, he doesn't really show up in costume, even though it's a very rich, lush, fabulous novel. He doesn't show up in costume the last 40 or 50 pages of the book. It's, you know, 450, 500 page book or something like that. Well, I can't do that in a comic. He's got a, so that's why we had the flashback scenario in the origin arc, and mm-hmm. also why I decided to go with kind of the slow burn of Zorro's appearance. You know, I figured, all right, he's a precursor of Batman. I'm really going to make it that he hides out in the dark. That's why he's wearing black. You know, you wouldn't dash around in the California sun in the middle of the day, clad to toe in black, you know? So as a result, we were able to portray him very mysteriously, and it was kind of from those portions of the tale were kind of from the point of view of the soldiers, that they didn't know what was attacking them, you know? This thing would come out of the darkness and attack them and be off, you know? Similarly, with that first Zorro storyline, I very much wanted to kind of go against your expectations, because everybody's seen a Zorro movie. Everybody loves Zorro. Everybody thinks they know all about Zorro. So I took a long time to expose a lot about Zorro that nobody knew. A lot of that was from her book. But also, I bet you didn't notice, because almost nobody really noticed. I take this as a point of pride that we were able to pull it off so subtly. There's no sword fight until the final issue of the eight-issue story arc, the origin arc.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's what everybody expects. Zorro has sword fights, right? That's what he does. Well, I was like, no, we got to. And, you know, this was a big thing with the licensor trying to convince them that this was the way to go, because they're like, no, Zorro has sword fights. Put lots of sword fights in. I was like, no, trust me. we're going to hold this off so that when it comes, it matters. And the way I won the argument was I pointed out, look, we didn't really see a decent lightsaber battle until the end of the second Star Wars movie. And by the time it rolled around, you were so ready for it. And so as a result, you know, we don't have a real sword battle. We see him in fencing practice and such, but no lengthy sword battle until the eighth issue, the final chapter of the origin arc.
Well, and I like the current tack too now of the focus on, in that Citizen Kane kind of way of, like, you know, informing the character secondhand through all these people who watch him in this Tales of the Fox arc. Why don't you talk about that?
Right. Well, that we finally have moved our way up the chain of command. In the first arc, the main villain is Sergeant Gonzalez. You see almost none of his immediate military superiors, except for a brief appearance by his captain. But obviously, you know, a sergeant in the army, well, that's not going to be Zorro's main opponent and main goal, you know. But in the second one, then, we get to meet the alcalde, the mayor of Los Angeles, and his master of arms, this kind of disgraced European nobleman who's kind of hot-headed and a deadly fencer. And then in the third arc, we finally moved up to the governor of California, the General Moncado. And, you know, at this point in history, the California government seat was in Monterey, not in Sacramento.
Okay.
So he's quite a bit to the north of Los Angeles, and, you know, considering what communication was like in those days, he wouldn't immediately be appraised or aware of this kind of rogue highwayman that was causing trouble far to the south. And when word does reach him, again, he's a general, he's a military leader, he doesn't fly into a rage. He slowly starts to gather information about his enemy and figure out how much of a threat this is. So that's why I went with this, you called it Orson Welles approach. You know, some of the issues are actually kind of, I would call them Rashomon.
Sure.
Sort of approach where you get several different viewpoints and they're all wrong of the main character of the main story part. And so he's, you know, he's a tactician. He's gathering information, and that's been a blast. It's good to have Francesco back too, because
he
just seems to get better and better and better every step he goes.
You know, I first became aware of him when he was working with Ben Licious on The Black Coat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you could tell. I mean, the guy was born to draw, you know, a swashbuckling action hero. And I know you've made references to his blog in interviews as well. And it is such a pleasure just seeing all of his adventure art. And he's such a pulp fan. And it's, he's perfect for the book. He really is.
Yep, he sure is. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And also, I like how you're in this arc as well, kind of attributing some more Batman-like characteristics. And I just think, you know, it evokes that kind of Gotham urban myth.
Well, I was going to say, you know, there's not much urbanity, but he's an urban myth at that point in that world. Yeah, huh?
Very cool.
And in fact, that first issue that was out is Moncado with a lot of his aristocratic colleagues, and they all have these opinions about what Zorro is. Well, then in an upcoming issue, there are various other ways of looking at the fox from different viewpoints. But in an upcoming issue, then we have an evening spent with the peons gathered around a fire and drinking, and, you know, in the aftermath of their workday. And they all start telling stories about Zorro, and their versions are completely different than the aristocratic versions, but they're equally wrong.
That's awesome.
And then ultimately, you know, Moncado's going to have to address, well, what and who is the real Zorro, so.
Well, and you know, Matt, we've had decades of really quality Zorro work in comics. You know, Toth, Don McGregor. I think a lot of really good creators have put their print on Zorro.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think you are definitely coming at the character from a different angle, and yet still.
That's the only reason to do it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's why I'm psyched too to see what you're going to do with the Green Hornet. I think at the end of the day, and I've heard a lot of the radio shows, and I always appreciate the idea behind the radio shows, but some of them are just too retro for me. And I love, like, Shadow. And
I'll go out on a limb here. They're boring as shit.
Thank you. Okay, there you go, man. And it's
nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens. And the Green Hornet shows up for a very brief period of time and doesn't do much. And most importantly, what I'm going to reveal about the Green Hornet is I'm going to tell you why. Green Hornet really doesn't have an outstanding origin arc. I did a recent interview and somebody said, well, I hope you're going to get into the essentials of the character, like the gas gun and the Black Beauty. And I was like, essentials? That's the surface dressing. That's the car.
Yeah,
the
those
gun.
Are the tools.
Yeah, right. That's not the why. That's not why Britt Reed, this heir to a newspaper fortune, would choose to do what he does. He has a venue for fighting crime. It's the same venue his father used, which was to crusade against crime through the pages of the newspaper. Why does he choose to adopt an alternate identity and go about it in this fashion? And I'm giving Kato a very specific origin as well. Part of the confusion about Kato has always been exactly what nationality is he, because they tend to change it here and there depending on which version it is, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the radio show he's continually referred to as his Filipino valet.
Yes.
And Filipino's not really a culture known for its martial arts skills.
So
in my version he's Japanese, and you know, Kato's a Japanese name, and I found a way to weave his origin around a very specific historical event. And it goes to explain why he bonds with Britt Reed. You know, why does this, you know, very unusually in the case of Green Hornet and Kato, you have a sidekick who's actually tougher than the main guy.
Yeah.
why does this very skilled martial artist follow around and behave, I don't want to say subserviently, but supportively to this character who's, you know, this white guy whose ass he could probably kick without blinking an eye. So I'm going to explain all that.
And this is different than the plans that Alex Ross has with the character. Am I correct?
Alex just covers.
Okay, so
there are other two. They're actually launching this as a legacy character. So I'm doing the Green Hornet Year One, the Golden Age
right.
stuff that takes place in the late 30s. That is the origin of Britt Reed and Kato. Kevin Smith is then writing the Silver Age version, and basically what he's doing is adapting that aborted screenplay he had back when he was tied up with the character at one point in for film development.
Gotcha.
So he's finally getting to bring that story to fruition so it doesn't just waste away. And in his version, it's the Silver Age version, so it's Britt's son. And then Brett Matthews, who writes Lone Ranger for Dynamite, is writing the near-future version. So it's set about 10 years from now.
Oh, okay. And is that tied to the movie at all, or?
No, none of them are tied to the movie. Nope, none of them are tied to the movie. We got no idea what's going on in the movie. We're just doing our version, and you know, hopefully we'll be able to sell some more books because of the movie coming out. So.
Well, two things. One is, I think, making Kato Japanese again. It's funny, you see, and I can understand from a modern standpoint, you're embracing the potential story problems that the actual people making the radio show back then were trying to avoid with, you know, obviously the Japanese Pearl Harbor
yep.
attack
yep. Mm-hmm.
falling during the radio show.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is extracting Britt from the Lone Ranger legacy, because that really, as you say, I mean, his real reason for becoming a hero was tied to the Lone Ranger, and so tied to the Lone Ranger.
We can't go into that, obviously, because again, the even though the entities were both created by the same creator,
yes.
the radio dramatist Fran Stryker, they were the legal rights to the copyrights were divided up at a certain point, and so they're owned by different entities now.
Yeah, it's
but,
crazy.
We you know, I mean, you know, Britt Reed's father is Daniel Reed, and in the Lone Ranger comic that Dynamite is doing, Daniel Reed is the nephew of John Reed, the Lone Ranger. And Brett has even dropped a few little hints that I'm picking up on in the origin tale. So we're doing it without doing it.
I understand. Well, you know, and I remember when Now Comics back in the early 90s were faced with the same problem. So, I mean, I think solutions are there.
Yeah, and I think they actually had a painting on Britt's wall of a character that looked like the Green Hornet or the Lone Ranger.
It did, and it even looked like a specific version of the Ranger that didn't look like the Clayton Moore version.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But it was that movie serial pre-Clayton Moore version of the Lone Ranger.
Yep.
So, yeah, well, and it's funny because I think you face the same. I don't think obviously anyone is as strict about it, but Vertigo using the DC characters you've been able to use in Madame Xanadu.
Yeah, well, there, you know, everybody asks me, how are you able to do that? And my answer is, I'm just doing it. I don't ask.
Good for you, man.
And so far, nobody stopped me, so
that's
I'm
awesome.
Going to keep doing it until somebody says, hey, you shouldn't do that.
No, but, you know, that's what has made enriching those characters and that era of DC more exciting, I think, is you just put a good wrinkle on it. And,
I tend to keep them. I tend to keep those references, A, they either fit into her scenario, or B, I keep them, you know, almost off camera. A lot of the references that were made in the origin arc, I mean, we got to see Etrigan, we got to see Zatara, and, of course, the Phantom Stranger's there for the whole thing.
Right. The Spectre.
And the Spectre, but then, you know, all we saw was the Mystic Lantern in Green Lantern in ancient China. and the Phantom Stranger very obliquely refers to the helmet of Dr. Fate.
Yep.
So we keep it kind of off to the side. And then, of course, in the Michael Kaluta run, I very actively went back to using the Golden Age Sandman, which, of course, was a return to form for me, but... I mainly did that because DC didn't have the rights to the Shadow. So I have Mike Kaluta drawing something set in the 40s, and I was like, well, I got to have a Shadow-type character in there, so I'm going to have the Sandman in there.
That's great.
In the current run, there's an appearance by a very unexpected DC character as well. So.
Well, I read the first chapter last week.
That character hasn't shown up yet. Shows up in the next chapter.
Excellent. So. Well, and this current arc does feel like a Sandman Mystery Theater kind of story. And has that
no, this arc, you'll be surprised. This arc is going nowhere anybody expects it to go.
Okay.
Yeah. And this arc is got a unique. You know, in the first arc, we would go by chapters of two issues each throughout time, and then of course in Michael's run. We had definite flashbacks to the days of the Spanish Inquisition. In this one, we also have some time shifting in regards to the narrative, and the way that works is that Amy's on for three. It's a total of 8-issue story arc. Amy's on for 3 issues, and then we have 2 issues that completely break and shift focus to a different time and a different period of reflection narratively. And those 2 issues are drawn by Joelle Jones, who's done some work for, did a book for Minx, and also has done quite a few things for Oni. Recently had a book come out from Oni, written by Jamie Rich, called You Have Killed Me, a very kind of traditional crime noir.
Yeah, I've been meaning to pick that up. It looks really
novel,
cool.
Yeah.
No, the art was great in that.
So
absolutely.
Joelle draws those middle 2 issues, and then we go back to Amy to finish out, and the narrative shifts back to where it was for the first 3 issues, and we finish out the story like that.
Very cool.
And again, it's going nowhere anybody expects. So
that's great. Well, you know, how did that happen, Matt? Did Vertigo come to you with Madame Xanadu, or did you come to them with the pitch?
No, I had no interest in it at all.
Who called you up?
It was Bob Schreck. Bob had just moved from the DCU to Vertigo, and he was really trying to get some stuff together, and the pitches and proposals he was making to Karen Berger just kind of weren't getting through the approval process, and he knew she wanted to get me back in the Vertigo realm for many a year. And you know, Bob and I have worked together a whole lot and know each other longer than either of us care to remember, probably. And and so he had this very unusual for me, because anything I've ever done in my career was not like this, was not somebody coming to me and saying, we want you to do this. And we have an artist we want you to work with. Normally, it's me generating an idea. I, you know, it's either my own stuff or if it's me working with DC, I go and say, you know, hey, I want to do a Batman story, or I have, you know, I had the idea for Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the pitch, blah, blah. And you know, when I collaborate with many different artists on Grendel, it's always me approaching them and me, I mean, the artist, hooking up with the artist beforehand and saying, hey, let's do something together. I didn't know Amy at all. I didn't know her work at all. She had come to Bob's attention via the efforts of his then assistant editor, Brandon Montclair, who used to work with Amy at Tokyopop. And so, you know, I was like, oh, Bob, I don't know. It's, you know, I'm not really seeing the connection with me and Amy because her stuff was very, very manga at that point.
Okay.
And he was just insistent, come on, give this a try, give this a try. And so I did some research on the character, and part of what appealed to me was that it was kind of a blank slate still. There was existing continuity there, but, you know, truthfully, nobody knows much of anything about her or gives a damn.
Sure.
And one of the points that jumped out to me was, 2 points, was that she's very long-lived, and in their continuity, she I didn't make up the point that she's Nimue, the nymph that seduces Merlin.
Right.
That was already in their continuity, but that she, in the current continuity, she has this kind of verging on enmity with the Phantom Stranger, and I was like, all right, bingo, there's something I can build a story on because there's human conflict, and I just came up with that idea. Let's go all the way through time. Let's find out how they grew to hate each other. and that was the whole point of the story. And in the course of that relationship, we solidified her purposing in what she does, why she opens up her shop in Greenwich Village, and why she makes her fortune-telling abilities available to anybody that needs help.
Well, that's why it's been so great to see her character develop under you, because you not only learn about her, but you do. You regard these other characters she comes in contact with in a completely different way, and certainly starting with the Phantom Stranger, but Merlin and Zatara and Jim Corrigan, and really even these short, brief moments both inform who Madame Xanadu is and give us further depth on these other existing characters.
Well, again, I'm filling in around the spaces there. You mentioned Jim Corrigan. You know, she was, I think when Ostrander was writing the Spectre for period of time there, she was appearing in the Spectre quite a bit, and she fulfilled a role as kind of like an advisor and a spiritual guide for Jim Corrigan. So I made up the point that, well, why does she do that? She does that. She's obviously doing that because she feels guilt that she did nothing to stop his murder, and so she's trying to earn a little bit of redemption there. Similarly, in their continuity, she gains her ongoing immortality. I have it set up so that she's immortal, but she has to take potions to maintain her youth. Right.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, she gains her immortality by playing a game of cards with Death, and I'm fairly certain in the original version it was probably, you know, Death the Grim Reaper, a skeleton guy in a long cloak. And I just thought, you know, we're in the Vertigo world, let's use Gaiman's Death, you
know? Absolutely.
So we just completely, totally retconned that part. But yeah, it's a fun character because the limits of what you can do are kind of, you know, magic stuff. It's pretty wide open.
And it sounds like you are going to continue and not just be, you know, in the 40s and 50s. You are going to take it to, at the very least, the present.
We'll get there eventually.
Okay.
I'm in no rush, and we're going to the next storyline is going to hop all around through time. So,
is this still because am I correct in assuming that James Robinson's charity character has a tie to this story?
Oh, I don't know James's charity character. What is that?
Okay, there was a tarot reader in Starman.
That's right. Oh, I need to go research that again.
And that's why, because I really think you two guys, especially, and you guys even crossed over during Sandman and Starman.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But that's the thing. You guys were really fleshing out an interesting area of the Golden Age DCU.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I was wondering, oh, is this another, you know, kind of crossover moment where you know, is Madame Xanadu eventually going to be somebody in Jack Knight's life?
That's a good idea, dude. I'll give you credit when we someday do it. How about
God bless you, dude.
But, well, that, you know, I mean, that's the way stuff runs in these. You know, half of it is you have a long-term plan to a certain degree, and then the other half is just, you know, the shit tumbles into your lap, just like you mentioning that. It's like, oh, that's a good idea. Let me go dig up a little bit on that, you know.
Very cool. Well, no, and that's – it's clear, Matt, that's how you like to play, and it's been, it was fun to see it, you know, 10 and 15 years ago in Sandman, and now you've got to – you know, this is obviously a completely different character, a much older character. You know, Wesley was totally different. He was just kind of finding who he was and everything and mm-hmm. kind of adopting this role. And that's why it's these stories, and especially where Madame Xanadu is, she's dealing with all the heroes that were there before the superheroes or the power wielders.
Yeah, right.
And so
yeah.
It's interesting to see how they solved the problems before the Mystery Men came on in the,
yeah,
in the 30s
I,
and 40s.
Probably, I won't be getting that much into the superheroes. Your description there, the power wielders, is the better description. It tends to be the magic characters.
Yeah, sure.
Now, that said, the mysterious one that I mentioned is going to appear probably breaks that mold a little bit. But I find the way I'm handling the character in the upcoming narrative really, I think when everybody reads it, they'll think it fits, too. So
that's cool. And watching the Phantom Stranger has been fun, too. And she is a different kind of adversary to the Stranger. Then it's funny, I just picked up the essential or the showcase of Phantom Stranger with a lot of Dr. 13 appearances in it.
Yeah, well, you know, he was a completely different character back then. He wasn't this grand mystical thing. He was more of almost a mysterious detective more than a...
And a guy that was disproving magic rather than...
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
A believer.
And of course,
that, you know,
he evolved into much more than that, so...
Yeah.
But I, you know, my point with the Phantom Stranger was to... make him kind of a contradiction and to show him actually doing something, because generally in the current storylines he tends to show up because I am the Phantom Stranger and he just disappears, you know, and what the hell does he do except
he's the Watcher, yeah,
talk ominously, yeah. and I wanted to show that no, he might claim that he can't interfere, but behind the scenes he's being much more manipulative than he lets on. And it's all about maintaining a cosmic balance, you know, and sometimes that means doing shit that looks just downright evil, you know. And I kind of take the approach. Did you ever see the Secret Origins they published a number of years ago that was, it had four Secret Origins of the Phantom Stranger?
Yes, I vaguely remember that. That was a while ago, but yeah.
And they never said which one was the real one, but of course Alan Moore wrote one of them, so of course that's probably the best one in there. And in his version, he's a fallen angel. He's the angel that wouldn't choose sides in the rebellion of Lucifer and the what became the devils.
Wow! Yeah.
So you know, in it's kind of like the bat in the old Aesop's fable. I don't know if you know that fable where the birds and the beasts are having a war, and the beasts come to the bat and say, "Join us, you're a beast," and he says, "No, I'm a bird." And the birds come and say, "Join us," and he says, "No, I'm a beast." And as a result, he's neither, and he's an outcast. And so that's the,
cool.
You know, I kind of adopted the Alan Moore version that he is this fallen angel that is, that his curse now is to maintain the balance, you know, to make sure that neither side ever gets too much of an upper hand.
That's very cool. And, you know, again, I like, you know, obviously jumping back and forth, you can put, Madame Xanadu and also these other people. I mean, their motivations are, as you say, as we said at the start, defined by their eras.
Yeah, right, exactly, yep. Mm-hmm.
So her motivations change as well as the eras change.
Yeah, absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting, and it's cool that you're able to bounce around like that. No, I think it's...
Hey, and speaking of eras, there's something we didn't... I'm going to backtrack here a little bit. We didn't get to talk about the fellow that's going to be drawing my Green Hornet run.
Yeah, please.
That's a young fellow named Aaron Campbell who drew Dynamite's recent Sherlock Holmes miniseries. It was written by Liam.
Oh,
Moore,
that was fantastic,
John
man!
Redion.
Beautiful
yeah.
work.
And he, you know, he's turned in like the first half, and as I much suspected, boy, he really it feels exactly like the time period it's supposed to feel like.
Outstanding.
Specifically, really happy with his Kato. Looks like a Japanese man of that era, and most importantly, does not look like Bruce Lee. You know, that's always the thing. Like, everybody draws Kato. Oh, shit, it's Bruce Lee again. And no, this Kato does not look like Bruce Lee. And,
very cool.
So very happy with his work on that.
That's great. You know, and again, the broad strokes of the character that Fran Stryker let out, you know, created were perfect for its time, but also, you know, it is different. It is different from the Shadow. It is different from, you know...
Okay, it's remarkably similar to the Lone Ranger, though.
Well, of course. Well, and of course.
When you look at it, because you look at it, you know, in addition to them supposedly being, the Ranger supposedly being his great-uncle, okay, they both wear a mask and a hat.
Oh, yeah.
They both operate outside the law. They both have an ethnic sidekick. They both have a special weapon. They both have a means of transportation that's named after a color. And they both have a very odd and up-tempo piece of classical music as their theme song. It's the same character, you know. Just...
Yeah, but the Ranger was a wanderer, whereas
Britt is not. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Britt is a guardian of his city and guardian of his territory.
Yep.
And again, I know you're going to cover that in the book in terms of why. But yeah, I mean that's the thing. And actually, I'd love to see a modern Britt Reed watching the Daily Sentinel crumble. So
right,
I,
but obviously, I mean that one will be the purview of Brett Matthews working on the.
Well, but even like you know, going to the what we were talking about with Superman and the Daily Planet and stuff like that, you know, it's that could be a very interesting Superman story.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, back to your characters. No, I'm psyched for this, man, and I loved his art on the Sherlock Holmes story. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I did too, and I'm finding I don't know, maybe a little unbiased opinion here, but this stuff's much better even. That could just be more pages under your belt, you know, to get better as you go.
No, I understand. Is there any interest in what else Dynamite is working with as far as characters from the 30s and 40s, the Project Superpower stuff? Are any of those...
Oh, no, not for me.
No?
And, you know, and these are enough to keep me busy for now. The Project Superpowers is all kind of... Isn't that all kind of Alex's baby? That's pretty much totally, you know... And I tend to want to have a little bit more of a free hand than having a Bible presented to me about here's what we're going to do with these characters, you know.
Oh, sure. No, I can understand that. Matt, weren't you with Wednesday's Comics?
No, I didn't. No.
Oh, okay. I could have sworn that you were.
No, in fact, when I finally got to see those, I was like, damn, this is one of the more exciting things they've done in a long time, and I'm really kind of pissed off nobody asked me to do one.
I was going to say, man, I think Jarell is going to have to call you because this is kind of perfect for what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been, but, you know,
Well,
are they going to do more of those?
I bet they are.
No, and you know, I like to play with format. So,
Speaking of format, what do you think of what's happening digitally right now, and how has that you know interested you as a creator, both as an artist and a writer?
Well, I'm not. My digital skills are not that great, so I don't see myself doing anything with it yet. But you know, I think it's you know, I was there at some of those early ranting lectures that Scott McCloud was giving about how, you know, print is technology and all technology becomes obsolete eventually. And so, I mean, that is the way it's going to go, for sure. Have you seen a Kindle? Have you played with a Kindle at all?
Well, and I think everyone's excited to see where the tablet goes.
Yeah, I mean, the Kindle won't be the one that becomes the paradigm for comic books, but just the fact that, you know, here's a computer that you can take to the beach.
But yeah, I was almost even wondering too, just from a story pacing standpoint, or even panel construction. I mean, we really can take advantage of a full comic page, and you can really do this, you know, impressive, scenic, you know, John Ford kind of establishing shot going to the phone. You know, that kind of detail is gonna, you know, maybe will go away because the screen is going to be smaller. I don't know. And I don't know.
Like, I just made a deal for Mage is now available on the iPhone. And,
okay.
And, you know, when I see it and look at it, yeah, it's all pretty cool. But, again, it's it does not have the sense of scope as what you're talking about.
Thank you, exactly.
And that is something that will, I don't know, will have to be addressed in some fashion. You know, I guess at one point what's going to happen is your phone will project a hologram, you know? Well, doesn't that make sense? I mean, that's what it'll be, right?
I suppose.
You won't be limited to the
box.
Yeah, that box, right.
That's interesting.
It's all about breaking it up, you know, or making it more convenient in every fashion, you know.
Well, and speaking of which, how involved were you in breaking up Mage?
Not at all. The guys that own the company, it's with Comixology.
Yes.
And they did a fabulous job. Looks terrific.
I was going to say, how did you feel, you know, once you read it as a creator? I mean, it, like, do they do things like where they might start off focused on a portion of a panel and then pop out to, you know?
Little bits of that, and it's set up so that you can look at the whole page and then zero in on panel to panel. Yeah, I was pretty impressed with the choices they made, you know, because of course there is a lot of decision making.
Sure. And again, that's for something that's, you know, existed as a page product.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I wonder, you know, do you see yourself maybe, you know, thinking of any projects that you might release in a digital form rather than?
Boy, you know what, man? I I'm such a, I'm antiquated in that regard. You know, I feel like I'd need a good 6 months to a year to just sit around and play and figure stuff out, and I just don't have that now. I'm too busy. You know, I got a mortgage. I got kids entering college. You know.
No, I understand.
If I get a couple movies made of my stuff and I get some luxury money, then maybe so. But
I understand.
But sure, I mean, I'm open to all that stuff. You know, it's the story that matters. It's not the format. You know.
I got you. What now? I heard some small movie rumblings at some of the later summer conventions. I don't know if there's any news on those fronts.
It's with Mage, and we're on the cusp of signing something, so I can't really announce it yet, but it looks pretty darn good. Pretty happy with the possibility.
And I know you had a recent big year with Grendel. Are there any future?
Yeah, I have another Grendel project in the back of my mind that we haven't gotten to yet, but we will. It's a Grendel Prime project. Also in the back of my mind is the fact that I have another creator-owned project that I'm going to get to.
Okay.
It's not there yet, but, you know, I mean, of all my colleagues, you know, not a lot of them have more than one creator-owned property, you know, they're known for, and I'm lucky enough to have two.
Yeah.
And now I think I'm going to go for a third one, so.
Very cool.
I just felt like, you know, I Major Grendel are great, but I've been doing them both for a long time, and I think I need a new venue. So
that's great. Will it be a different area of story that you haven't really explored?
Totally different. It'll be
very cool.
Like nothing else I've ever done.
Well, that's what I think these current projects that you're working on, it really is playing to all your strengths. I mean, it's, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, Madame Xanadu certainly has her ties in the Arthurian world, and mm-hmm. has working on that kind of informed where, you know, whenever you do get back to Mage, where it might take you?
No, not really. Because Mage, I think I've mentioned this to you before too. Don't like to think about Mage too much. I like to have Mage be an improvisational act.
Okay.
I don't do any notes with Mage. I don't do any thumbnails. I sit down and I let Mage take me where it wants to go.
Yeah, I know. Well,
and there's nothing else I really do in that free form of a fashion.
How does Grendel work, then?
Well, Grendel just has a little more consideration to it. You know what I mean? I kind of know what's going to happen in the story before I start. And certainly at this point in my career, I'm not somebody that over-prepares. You know, I don't sit around and do, you know, 100 pages of sketches in developing something, you know? But Grendel, you know, again, I know what the storyline is. I know how it's going to end. Mage, not so. Not so at all. Like really not so. But yeah, the new one will be something nobody's ever seen out of me before. So,
well, I hope Madame Xanadu has a long and healthy Sandman-like run, and I think we're off to an interesting start. And this third arc is just getting started, but the volume one is available now, and I know the Kaluta volume is coming out in February.
Pretty
correct?
Soon, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's in the current previews.
I think it is. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's awesome. And yeah, good. You know, good luck with Xanadu. And yeah, really, Zorro's been a blast. And you know, I know that Green Hornet is in the right hands when it comes to the Golden Age story. So
yeah, you know, that all just kind of made sense. You know, but the funny thing is, when addressing the Green Hornet, it well, obviously, I've done these sort of characters before. I've done Sandman. I've done Batman. You know, and I've done Zorro. And it's like, when I went through the Green Hornet, it's like, wow, and he is really none of those characters. He's completely different. So that's been kind of fun.
No, I think it's going to be really neat. And the cool thing is looking at these time periods, and you always manage to find a different sliver of that era expressed through the characters that you're doing. Like I said, I mean, Madame Xanadu's experience in the 30s and 40s, very different from Wesley Dodd's.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
and I'm
far.
Looking forward
yeah.
to that same difference in Britt Reed.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
And Kato. Very cool, Matt. We'll keep it up, and we'll look for you then on the magazine racks.
Right on, man.
This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Funimation and their latest feature, Evangelion 1.01. You're not alone. The movie is the complete rebuild of the groundbreaking sci-fi giant robot anime. Imagine having Dr. Frankenstein as your father. Your classmate and fellow pilot is a partial clone of your dead mother, and she's hot. You've been forced by your father to pilot a giant living robot named Ava Unit 01 to fight deadly creatures called angels from destroying the planet. And to top it off, you have raging teenage hormones, and it's the end of the world if you screw up. No pressure. Otaku USA Magazine writes that Evangelion reminds us of what anime can be by having us flex all our okaru muscles, yet always satisfies our basest needs for cute girls and mecha. You can watch the first 8 minutes of the movie online at Funimation.com/EVANGELION. That's Funimation.com/Evangelion. Evangelion 1.01, You're Not Alone. It's available now on DVD. And that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. John Suntress reminding you to check out our new look at wordballoon.com. We gave the site a good facelift, and you can check out some of the new bells and whistles. More is coming, more changes coming to wordballoon.com. But as always, you can find our programs at newsarama.com. Please subscribe to our Word Balloon feed, either through the website wordballoon.com or over at iTunes. Any questions or comments about the show, feel free to reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. A new episode is coming later in the week. I want to give you something to enjoy over the Thanksgiving weekend. So be looking to wordballoon.com and Newsarama and iTunes for that update. But until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.